tired of hearing about tariffs on our show? Well, good news for you, because today we're going to talk about non-tariff trade barriers. Plus, what could possibly be in a $25 box of Frosted Flakes? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. From the studios at Colorado Public Radio in Denver, I'm Amy Scott, in for Kai Rizdahl. It's Monday, the 23rd of July. Good to have you with us. On Wednesday, European Union President Jean-Claude Juncker will be in Washington to discuss, you guessed it, trade policy. Over the weekend, U.S. Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin said the U.S. is ready to negotiate with the EU, China, and Japan on trade as long as our trading partners agree to remove tariffs on U.S. goods, as well as what he called non-tariff barriers on U.S. companies. Marketplace's Mariel Segarra explains what those are.
We hear a lot about tariffs. Those are taxes on foreign goods. But then there's this other thing called non-tariff trade barriers. Kathleen Clausen teaches law at the University of Miami.
Quite simply, a non-tariff trade barrier is a measure other than tariff posing a barrier to free trade. Think about it as the red tape.
That's a broad category. Mireya Solis at the Brookings Institution says it can include measures that are blatantly discriminatory, like when China forces U.S. companies to give up their technology.
Companies, when they invest in China, they have to share their proprietary technology with Chinese counterparts, and that obviously erodes their competitiveness.
But these barriers can also include things like health and safety regulations. For instance, when a country passes stricter fuel emission standards for cars, that country might cite environmental protection.
Whereas the foreign counterpart may argue that this is done intentionally to try to prevent cars from other countries to enter the market.
Non-tariff trade barriers have become a big sticking point in international trade discussions. Rachel Brewster, who teaches law at Duke University, says that's because tariffs are actually still pretty low.
When the Trump administration says other states aren't acting fairly and puts on tariffs to punish them, that is all because of other states' non-tariff barriers.
These barriers are likely to come up later this week when the president of the European Commission visits President Trump in Washington. I'm Mariel Segarra for Marketplace.
Seeing a lot of for sale signs in your neighborhood? Summer home buying season is well underway. But according to numbers out today, fewer homes are selling amid tight supply and rising prices. The National Association of Realtors says sales of existing homes fell in June for the third straight month. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer explains why economists keep a close eye on those sales.
Think of existing homes as used cars. They're homes that have already been lived in. They can be a year old or 100 years old.
It is the bulk of the home sales.
Lawrence Yoon is the National Association of Realtors chief economist. He says around 90% of the houses sold in the U.S. are existing homes. That's why they're such a good barometer of the housing market. But they're expensive. Yoon says that's one reason existing home sales are down.
Home values have been consistently outpacing people's wage growth, income growth for the past 5 years.
The problem? An acute shortage of existing homes for sale. Homeowners are afraid if they sell their house, they won't be able to afford a new one. But aren't new homes being built? Couldn't they make up for the shortage? Nope. Anthony Sanders is a housing economist at George Mason University. He says fewer new homes are being built now because it's hard for builders to find workers. Land is expensive.
And then we have costs of building materials are going through the roof.
But some housing economists think we may be turning a corner. Svenja Gudell is chief economist at Zillow. She says the white-hot housing market is cooling in some parts of the country.
You have to do fewer offers at this point to come up with that lucky bid at the end of the day.
But Goodell is quick to add that we're far from a normal housing market. We just might be turning in that direction. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
On Wall Street, not much to write home about. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. $10 10 years ago, the financial crisis changed the global economy as we knew it. If you've been following our project, Divided Decade, you've heard some of the many ways that crisis also affected people's personal economic lives. In today's installment of our series, How We Changed, we hear from Shante Ray, talking to us from one of the three toy stores she owns in the St. Louis area.
In 1995, I took a job as a clerk in a little toy store in Edwardsville while I was getting my BFA in sculpture, and I feel like kind of became a natural retailer. My husband was very supportive and seemed like he was willing to dive in and lead a toy life with me. So we bought three giant stores with 35 employees, and the future was wide open. 2008, the holidays kind of didn't come. We didn't sell any dollhouses. We didn't sell any castles. Train tables had stopped. And we came out of that season with a what the heck is going on? What just happened? Part of our strategy during the worst part of the crisis was to go directly to our bank and talk to them. They could see it going on with everyone, so it wasn't a surprise that we were also struggling. And we renegotiated the terms of our SBA loan. In 2013, we went to our normal bank appointment, and the bankers called the entirety of our loan. We were shocked and heartbroken. The bank guy cried with us. We cried, and we were crushed. We sent out a letter on a Friday afternoon telling everyone that we were closing our stores. And at that point, hundreds and hundreds of families came. People were like, what are you talking about? This can't be possible. You know, I had moms that are like, my water broke in your store. As all these families were coming in, the question kept coming up, well, what do you need? Like, how much do you need? And we said, it's a lot. I don't know. We don't know what we need to keep going. But we were kind of forced to give a number. And so we said, well, if we had $75,000, then we could push the bank off. But I'm not comfortable with that, you know, and that's kind of where we left it. My husband and I, it was our 10th wedding anniversary, Pi Day, 2013. My phone exploded and they had raised $82,000 and were giving it to me, no strings attached. And we were floored. When you have a town that says, we really want you here, you know, that's a very powerful statement. By their grace is the only reason we're here. Well, and my hard work.
The company Shante Ray and her husband own is called Happy Up Inc. We've got some pictures on our Instagram at Marketplace APM. And while you're there, tell us your story with the hashtag #HowWeChanged. Welfare has been back in the news lately, with the White House Council of Economic Advisors calling earlier this month for reform of social programs like food stamps and rental housing assistance. But while welfare has long been one of those hot-button issues that people tend to have a lot of opinions about, the facts about how the system works in this country aren't so well known. Over the last few years, our wealth and poverty team has been working to change that in their podcast, The Uncertain Hour. Marketplace's Chrissy Clark led an investigation into how federal welfare funding actually gets spent across the country, and the answers are pretty surprising. She joins me now with an update on her reporting. Hi, Chrissy.
Hey, Amy.
So we use the word welfare to mean a lot of things. What are we talking about specifically today?
Yeah, so it can be used to refer to everything from food stamps to Medicaid. But what we're talking about right now is the program known as Temporary Assistance for Needy Families, or TANF. And this is the federal program that provides cash assistance to poor families. After welfare reform in 1996, cash assistance stopped being something based strictly on need. And now there are lots of work requirements and time limits involved. The other thing that changed is that welfare became a block grant capped at about $16.5 billion a year. And now each year, the federal government gives a certain amount of TANF money to each state. States have to contribute some of their own funds. And then the key part is that each state decides how they're going to spend their pot of federal and state TANF money. And they are given a lot of flexibility.
And what do we know about how states are actually spending the money?
So they're spending it in some pretty unexpected ways. The first surprise is that for the last few years, if you look at all the states combined, only about a quarter of TANF funds goes to actual cash assistance to poor families. Then another quarter of the funds goes to what you might call work supports, things like job training and childcare, transportation to and from work. But that's all to say that just a little more than half of TANF funds go to what most people think of as like the core purpose of welfare, which is money directly assisting poor families or helping them get a job.
Where does that leave the other half?
So that's where things get even more surprising. So states use some of it to fill their own budget gaps for unrelated things like pre-K and child protective services. And then there's this kind of crazy quilt of other programs that the money goes to. For many years, for example, in Oklahoma, some welfare funding was going to marriage counseling workshops, not just for poor couples, but for anyone who signed up. And then Michigan is an interesting example. About 15% of TANF funds there go into college financial aid and scholarship programs. And these largely benefit students from middle and upper income families, not just poor kids. So, in fact, when you crunch the numbers, actually more TANF money is going to these college scholarship programs in Michigan than to actual cash assistance for needy families.
Wow. Is that because there are just fewer families that need that help?
No. So nationally, poverty has slightly declined in the last couple years since the recession when it spiked. But the poverty rate is just about as high as it was back in 1996 when we overhauled welfare. Around 13% of Americans live below the poverty line, and that's about $24,000 a year for a family of four. The other startling thing that I found in my reporting is that nationally, very few families who are poor receive cash assistance. In fact, there are more avid postage stamp collectors than there are people who get cash welfare in the country. Nationally, just 23 out of every 100 families who live at or below the poverty line gets cash assistance. In more than a dozen states, the decline is even more pronounced. Less than 10 out of every 100 poor families gets cash assistance.
And what's behind that decline?
So part of it is the time limits. You're just not allowed to receive assistance for as long, even if you are still struggling with poverty. It's also just a harder program to navigate now. The application process is more difficult and more time-consuming. There are these work requirements that can be hard to meet. So for families who don't have a lot of resources, that might just discourage them from even applying.
In your reporting, what did you find in terms of what this actually means for families who are out there struggling to get by and could use that cash assistance?
Yeah, so I've talked to people who sell their blood plasma to get by. There are also just the everyday tough choices that families face. I talked to one mom who on a given day might be grappling with whether to buy toilet paper or cough syrup for her kids because she just did not have enough money to buy both.
So the hard question, what is being done, if anything, about this?
So there is a welfare reform bill that has been introduced in the House that would put more oversight on how states spend their money. And in the hearings leading up to the bill, a member of Congress actually pointed to things that we had revealed in our reporting, like these college financial aid programs that were getting TANF money that was going to higher income families. They pointed to that as one of the problems with how the program works these days. The bill had been expected to come to the floor this month. But in the run-up to the midterm elections, it looks like welfare is just too hot-button a topic to touch right now. So we'll have to see.
All right. Chrissy Clark, host of our documentary podcast, The Uncertain Hour. Chrissy, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
And you can see our updates to how your state spends welfare money at marketplace.org. Coming up.
For the first time, children with disabilities are entitled to more than just the bare minimum.
But what if schools can't offer much more than that? First, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell 13 points, less than 0.1%, closed at 25,044. The NASDAQ picked up 21 points, 0.2%, to finish at 7,841. And the S&P 500 rose 5 points, 0.1%, to end at 2,806. More than a third of companies in the S&P 500 report earnings this week. Investors will be watching for signs that tariffs are affecting company decision-making. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.96%. And you are listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Amy Scott. When you think about buying this week's groceries, chances are Amazon isn't your go-to destination, at least not yet. But that doesn't mean food isn't selling on the site. Niche and novelty food products are increasingly popular on Amazon, which has kind of turned it into a laboratory for testing new food products. Vanessa Wong has written about this. She's the deputy business editor for BuzzFeed News. I asked her for some examples.
Some of their best-selling products include like protein powder and like weird chocolate-covered almonds that you've never heard of and strange like limited time or promotional offerings from some of the bigger food manufacturers. So like one of the big themes this summer, you might notice a lot of like Jurassic World food being launched on Amazon, which includes like a $25 box of Kellogg's Frosted Flakes that comes with a digital screen loaded with behind-the-scenes footage of the film, which you can only get from a box of cereal on Amazon.
You know, $25 sounds pretty cheap.
It's true. Like, you know, included. It's kind of interesting. I was wondering, like, who actually buys this stuff? And I found this guy who bought the Jurassic World Frosted Flakes and admitted that, like, in no sense was it worth $25. He could have, like, bought the cereal and, like, gone to see the movie for less than that.
Why are they putting some things on Amazon that you wouldn't find, say, in a grocery store?
There are a couple of reasons. It's kind of like a lower risk environment. So at traditional grocery stores, they actually charge manufacturers a fee to have their products on display. And so there's that, you know, there are a lot of kind of logistical complications and supply chain things that get in the way of launching a new product. And when you go on Amazon, you kind of like have a lot more control over the situation in terms of like how many you sell, how many you produce, how it's marketed. The thing that is a little bit complicated about Amazon is that Amazon obviously has a lot of control over like algorithms and like where your things show up, which obviously has a lot of impact on whether or not consumers see them and buy them.
And how does this fit into Amazon's overall strategy? I mean, obviously, with the purchase of Whole Foods, it's a bigger player in the grocery space. Is this part of its larger effort to take over?
You know, when it comes to Amazon's strategy, who can really say at this point? They are like all over the place. But in terms of their food strategy, obviously, they're trying to beef up like what types of offerings they have for customers. And one of the ways to like differentiate themselves from brick and mortar grocery is to like have a different product assortment. So, you know, by getting food startups to launch their kind of like novel and novelty snacks and big manufacturers to kind of like try out promotional items and other things, it kind of like brings customers to your site in thinking about food.
Right. Well, how long do you think before we might get there where people go to Amazon for their regular groceries, not just their Jurassic World Frosted Flakes?
I think we're a long ways from there. E-commerce has had a lot more success in other industries like electronics, apparel, things that ship well. Groceries is complicated. I mean, aside from like snacks and, you know, kind of other dry goods that aren't temperature sensitive, et cetera, it's really hard to get people like, you know, regular food that they can cook that day. The market share of like e-commerce and food is tiny. It's like less than 5% still.
Vanessa Wong is deputy business editor for BuzzFeed News. Thanks.
Thanks so much, Amy.
At last count, more than 6.5 million public school children receive special education services. How schools educate those children is governed under a federal law that covers 13 disabilities. A lawsuit about that law went all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court last year. The court's ruling changes what kinds of services schools and districts are legally obligated to provide. Marketplace's Lizzie O'Leary went to find out what that means for the country's largest school district, New York City.
Morning, come in. This is Aiden.
Hi, Aiden. I'm Lizzie.
Hi, Lizzie.
Hi.
In a bright orange shirt, 8-year-old Aiden's ready to show off what he's learning in third grade.
Bonjour.
Bonjour.
French. His mom, Alana Philip, remembers meeting his French teacher.
I said, French? He's studying French?
Because in pre-K, Aiden was diagnosed with a subtype of autism.
One thing that really comes out clearly is it seems as though this thing is going to take a lot of money.
There was the occupational therapist, so Aiden could learn to hold a pencil, the reading program at $150 a session, and
a private neuropsych eval, and that costs $4,500 out of pocket.
In New York City, within 60 days of requesting an evaluation, parents, teachers, and other school staff are supposed to hash out and implement a student's Individualized Education Program, or IEP. Under federal law, it's the document that lays out exactly what services a student with disabilities gets. Here's Alana Philip again.
Actually, what I had to really fight for was one-to-one tutoring and extra support.
As we know, not all schools have the same resources.
That's Lori Podvesker. She's an advocate at Include NYC, a nonprofit that helps students with disabilities access services. She says schools sometimes make recommendations based on what they can give, not necessarily what students need. In the past, New York students with disabilities were often taught separately in their own classes. But then in 2010,
they changed the funding formula.
Now the district gives schools more money if they keep kids with disabilities in mainstream classrooms. The idea being that if you educate students with disabilities alongside their peers, they'll do better academically and socially. But is just that enough? Again, Lori Podvesker, who's a proponent for these kinds of classrooms.
My gut reaction is no. There's still a huge achievement gap between students with disabilities in New York City and general education students.
New York City schools spent $3.7 billion on classroom instruction for special education students last year, about 30% of such spending. And they're doing better at getting students classroom services than ever before. But still, 1 in 4 kids don't get the full services they're legally entitled to. Two families recently sued the district. In a statement, the New York City Department of Education says they ensure students with disabilities have access to education in, quote, the least restrictive environment, and they say they try to resolve concerns as quickly as possible. Nationwide, a lot of families have sued. Jack Robinson represented a Colorado family whose case went to the Supreme Court.
You have this inherent tension between what the parents want and believe is necessary for their child to succeed and, you know, what the school district is willing to do, whether it's financially or just conceptually.
The Supreme Court ruled unanimously that just access to education is not enough. Chief Justice John Roberts wrote schools need to offer services so students, quote, make progress appropriate in light of the child's circumstances.
For the first time, children with disabilities are entitled to more than just the bare minimum.
The federal law, which gives students with disabilities rights to an education, also promises funding to cover 40% of extra special education costs. Today, only 14% of those funds have come through, leaving it up to states and districts to figure out how and what they can pay for. Since the Supreme Court ruling, the Federal Education Department released guidance to schools clarifying their increased duties. What we don't know yet is how that will play out for students like Aiden or anyone else with a disability.
70 divided by 10. What multiplied by 10 would give us 70? Correct. Good boy. High five.
For now, it likely still means a lot of hard work. In New York, I'm Lizzie O'Leary for Marketplace.
You can check out a Marketplace special report on the economics of disability. Hear more stories about work and healthcare, all at marketplace.org. The And this final note, the New York Daily News lost half of its newsroom staff today. Publisher Tronc Inc., which also owns the Chicago Tribune and the Baltimore Sun, among others, bought the tabloid last year for just a dollar plus the outstanding debt. In a note sent to employees, the company said efforts so far to stem revenue losses have not gone far enough. The cuts include the paper's editor-in-chief, Jim Rich, who tweeted, and I quote, "If you hate democracy and think local governments should operate unchecked and in the dark, then today is a good day for you." That's it. We got to go. The Dow Jones fell 13 points, less than 0.1%. The Nasdaq picked up 21 points, 0.2%. And the S&P 500 rose 5 points, 0.1%. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bodner, Maria Hollenhorst, Sean McHenry, and Daisy Palacios. Our special projects desk includes Tommy Andres and Eliza Mills. Caitlin Esch is the producer on our wealth and poverty desk. And I'm Amy Scott, in for Kai Rizdahl. Have a good day, and we'll see you tomorrow. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
"What is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?"
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.